Hi, I'm Rebecca Arnott, and today I'm up at the Droughtmaster National Bull Sales in Rockhampton. Here, producers are preparing for a big breeding season as they continue to rebuild their herds after years of drought. For the second year running, records are tumbling and people are revelling in the rare alignment of both good seasonal conditions and high commodity prices. While confidence is high, these extraordinarily unusual times inevitably challenge our thinking, raise new questions, and often result in either shorter term or lasting changes. Many of the questions our Repro 360 team are being asked centre around bull affordability, getting a return on such a significant investment, and at what point do you start consider AIing some of your females instead of buying as many bulls? Others are asking about structural soundness, breed plan figures, and the importance of morphology testing. I've been fortunate enough to run into Emily Elling, who is not only a vet, but also a passionate young cattlewoman. In fact, she's just sold a few bulls this morning, so I thought I'd ask her to share some of her thoughts and insights around the future of beef breeding in the north. Emily, welcome, and thanks for agreeing to have a yarn at such short notice. I'm thinking you must be on a bit of a high after your success in the ring this morning.
Thank you, Beck. Thank you for asking me to come along and have for a chat. It feels really great to be here. Yeah, we're very excited. We're certainly happy to be, seeing the bulls go on to their new homes, and we hope that they do everything that they should do as well. And we're excited. We've got some new ones ourselves, so we can take our new little presents home, and that'll be exciting as well. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. You grew up on a cattle property outside Theodore in central Queensland, where you developed your love of all things cattle. Tell us a bit about your childhood and the farm itself.
Yeah, I had a wonderful childhood. I'm very close with my family, and we have got two places that we run stud stock and commercial stock on. We have drought masters. We're a full drought master herd, purebred on both sides, and we also do some hay sales and a little bit of cropping as well. My dad is actually from Theodore all his life, so he's Theodore born and bred, and mum's the city girl, but she's incredibly tough and she fits right into life out there beautifully. And I guess I've loved animals all my life, and I'm so lucky to be able to have worked with them all my life as well. And that definitely encouraged my passion to want to go and do those things. And working with cattle in particular, it just feels at home, I suppose, and when I've been away from home and worked in other areas, working with cattle has always been my comfort zone, yeah.
You went on to study veterinary science at James Cook University in Townsville, and have since spent about 5 years working as a vet in central Queensland, doing as much large animal work as you can. And as of this month, you've moved back to Theodore, where you're going to juggle working as a vet and working on the family farm.
Yep.
What prompted this move, and what are your medium to longer term goals on the farm, and particularly from a cattle breeding perspective?
Yeah, triggering the move was that I wanted succession, I suppose, wanting to be able to work in with my family and my partner as well, both of us wanting to have a crack and pop our hat in the ring and see how we go. And I guess our medium to long term goals, long term goal definitely would be to build up our stud side of it. Of the business quite a lot, and be able to increase our paddock sales exponentially, and then in terms of commercial selling and buying is a huge part of, I guess, the Australian beef industry, and to be able to be part of that would be really great, and I would love to build up on that and improving the quality of the animal we're selling and the carcass that we can provide to, I guess, consumers. And as well, big thing for us is to sell a reliable bull that's from a transparent background. You can see exactly what he is, you can ask us all the questions and we can give you all the answers, and he's jumped through all the hoops. That's our big goal, is to be able to provide something that we're proud of at all the time. Yeah,
we've all heard plenty of stories about kids coming back to the family farm agitating for change and rocking the boat. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if your parents will be listening to this, but how receptive are they to your ideas, and how do you encourage them to jump onto your train of thinking?
They're very good. My dad loves to have a joke with everybody at the moment and tell everybody that he started chewing Panadol because I'm coming home, but I think they're really excited. Both of my parents are incredibly open-minded and very, very intelligent people, and they are those who will love to learn and love to work with young people as well. They both have a big passion for working with young people in different areas of their life. So I think we'll work really well together. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Now, with your vet, seed stock and commercial producer hats on, what do you think is the best way of rebuilding our vastly depleted cow herds after so many years of drought, mm-hmm. and particularly given both cow and bull prices are so high at the moment?
Yes, fertility is number one. You know, focusing on your fertility and making that number one priority. I think in terms of pregnancy testing, making sure that your bulls are tested and that they're tested every year, even your herd size, and making sure that they are performing. Because if you want to rebuild, you need to get those babies on the ground, you need to get those calves on the ground, you need to know that your girls are doing the job as well as the bulls. And, you know, nutrition obviously comes into that as well, hugely. But rebuilding, especially for us, because we've been through the drought, a big thing at the moment for us is fertility, hugely. And looking at, yeah, morphology in our bulls that we're buying, and knowing that we've got, you know, all those boxes ticked so that we've got confidence that we can put a bull out in the paddock and think, well, he's gone through all those check boxes, he's gone through all those hoops, he should be able to do that job. Yeah.
And are you seeing an increased shift to assisted breeding or AI?
Definitely.
Based on these high prices?
Yes, definitely, absolutely. Even for ourselves, we need to buy a number of bulls this year, but given bull prices, we're probably not going to be able to buy the number of bulls we require. So we will be, you know, instead you change your plan of attack and you go, right, we're going to buy this number of bulls, and then we'll do an AI program as well to fill the gap, basically. Absolutely, yeah.
And would that fast track the genetic improvement as well?
Incredibly, absolutely. Because, yeah, when you can go and buy straws, you know, buying straws is so much cheaper than to buying, $100,000 bull, for example. You know, it allows you then to pick some genetics you might not have been able to buy in the flesh. Yeah.
Mm. And Emma, are you seeing an increasing trend in on-farm bull collection, which then enables that bull to be spread over hundreds of females rather than just 30 or 40?
Yes.
To better utilise that investment?
Definitely. And that's something that, you know, even in my own circumstances that we're going to be doing and looking at doing because of exactly that reason. You know, it means that you could spread a bull across so many more cows and do it safely without breaking that bull down or, you know, making him work harder than he needs to. That sort of thing, yeah, and having some longevity in the animals that you do have as well, yeah.
So how does that process work? You buy a bull from the sale.
Yep.
I guess the first thing to do is perhaps get some insurance.
Yes.
And then I guess often they're either taken to a collection centre or you'd take them home and get someone like BBS or I don't know, would you do that yourself?
Yeah, definitely. You can do it either way. I think you've got to consider where the animal's been, where the animal's coming from as well. You know, it's a stress. It can be stressful for them. They're here, so especially for these bulls and bulls that are going to multi-day sales. They're traveling long distances. Then they're coming to these sales, and then to then be asked to collect really quickly and straight away. Some bulls will find that stressful, you know. So I think that's when the cattleman comes out, you know, and that beautiful nature of reading your animal, because you need to make your decision. Is the bull going to collect well now if I do him straight away, or do I need to give him, you know, a couple of weeks just to get himself at home and then try that sort of situation? But I guess in terms of insurance and, you know, and those types of things, if you've bought a bull and you get him collected straight away, you've got a means of insurance straight away. You know, you've got that insurance in the tank, and I think that's a really clever thing to do and a smart thing to do. On-farm bull collection is definitely, I feel, on the rise. You know, I'll be doing mine, I suppose. And I'm, many people that you talk to around the ring, I suppose, are doing exactly that, yeah.
So a lot of people are outlaying a lot of money for bulls.
Yep.
You've touched a little bit on the checks and balances that are done before the sale to ensure you're getting a sound bull that can get the job done. Do you want to elaborate a little bit more on that? Because you've got your bull check accreditation and just what that entails.
Yes. So I guess, you know, number one is, well, for me, I guess, I suppose, for me, when I'm going and doing my bull checks on sale bulls, I'm looking at an animal that I'm thinking, right, well, would I be prepared to buy this bull, for example, you know, and can this bull survive? You know, can he walk? Can he get to water? Can he eat? Those, for me personally, those are the three big things I look at first. You know, can this bull actually survive? And then, you know, you're looking through, quality of bull. So you're looking at feet, you're looking at legs. Can they mount a cow? Can they actually serve a cow? Can they hold their weight? you're looking at, you know, eyes and their face and, you know, what's going on there. Then you're getting to the body, and then you get to the crux of it, which is obviously, can they create a semen sample? Are their testicles normal? Are they palpating normal? You do your internal exam and fill everything in there as well. Are they letting a Downer sample normally? Can you see any anatomical abnormalities that could be genetic, which then could really get down the line and cause ongoing issues? And then you're looking at your semen as well. So for those bulls, you know, coming up that race, you are examining them. I think for me, when I'm getting out of the car, I'm looking at them from the time I get out of the car to the time I leave and watching them, and you take everything in. You've got to really be aware of your surroundings and what are those bulls like out there, you know. And I've listened to a lot of far more experienced vets than me that do their bull checks, and I listen to things that they have learned over time as well, and that's something that through them I have learned, is take in your surroundings, see what's happening, as well as the stuff that's on paper is incredibly important as well. Yeah. Mm.
I'm not sure what proportion of bulls break down in the first year or two, but yep, you do hear plenty of stories. What are the main causes of that happening?
For myself personally, the most common reasons for bull breakdown in the first 12 months generally comes down to their feet and legs. Unfortunately, multiple vets that I speak with are exactly the same. But bulls are fed differently these days to prepare them for sale. The market is a different market to what it was, you know, not even 10 years ago, really. So feet and legs, probably the biggest thing. And then, yeah, unfortunately, there are some issues with, I guess, semen quality and fertility and those types of things too. But I guess feet and legs would be the biggest thing there. Obviously, being a drought recently and having been dry in the recent seasons, we're all pretty lucky at the moment, but it has been very dry. Bulls have had to work harder than ever, I think, in some places. Bulls sometimes get stretched across more cows than what they should be as well, given the fact that the market is so much more expensive, so you're seeing bulls getting overworked as well. That's where you realise how important your role is as a vet who's going out and seeing these bulls, because you realise that there can be so many repercussions from what you're doing. Yeah.
Are you seeing more British breeds come up into the north, and what are your thoughts on how best to manage those from a reproductive perspective?
Look, to be honest, a lot of British breeds are really great reproductively, you know, and they're a lot more early maturing, and they often perform really well in regarding that. However, yeah, coming up into the heat, those poor boys, they come up and they tongue and they pant and they feel the heat. So you do need to let them down a little bit slower, you know, looking after them when you buy them, not just bushing them straight out into the trees, you know, just letting them have some time to settle in. I think there's in terms of the commercial side of beef production, there's a huge market for those British breeds. You know, they're adding in a lot of weight to the carcasses. They're adding in a lot of other, you know, they're adding in a lot of more of the desirable traits that they're looking for. So I think that there's definitely a space for them, there's a gap for them, but I also believe there's always going to be room for our indicus breeds, because I believe that in Australia you need to have your Brahmins or your Droughties or your indicus breeds to survive our heat, especially in our northern parts, because otherwise they're just going to feel it too much, and that's when they're going to not drink and not walk to water or not eat, those types of things. And that's, I'm a big believer in just getting back to basics, really. We all do. We all get so caught up in all the extra stuff and all the new technology and everything like that. But if you can get into those basics and really think about just that sort of stuff and lay that foundation down, I think it's so important. Yeah.
I've heard a school of thought that you're better off bringing the British breeds up when they're younger, mm-hmm. perhaps, so mm-hmm. they can adapt more as they're growing, mm-hmm. and rather than perhaps older ones that might have been in a feedlot situation, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. can then go yep. downhill.
Yes.
What are your thoughts around that?
I definitely agree. You see some really big mature bulls who have been in those really heavy situations where they have been fed quite a lot. And going into a paddock situation rather than a feedlot, it's very, very different. It's like sitting in the front of the fridge and then having to walk to the fridge, I suppose. Yeah, it's a very different scenario. I think younger bulls are able to adapt. They're generally a lot lighter and weight. They've often not been conditioned to the beautiful feed feed that they can get in a feedlot. They're able to adapt quicker, get on their feet quicker. I find that some producers find that older bulls of the British breeds that are brought into northern areas have to look after them more, and if you're looking after them, that means they're not in the cows, and you know, it's a ticking time sort of situation. Yeah.
Em, you sound like a natural leader and a great ambassador for both young vets and girls interested in pursuing a career in the beef industry. You're currently the young graduate representative on the Australian Cattle Vets Executive Committee. What does this entail?
I mainly am involved in sort of organising webinars and those types of things, so that we can have our members have furthering education despite the fact that they're generally rural and remote and can't get into big cities or centres to get to meetings and things like that all the time. That's my main role. But I also try my very best amongst everything else to connect with the young graduates. I probably could do a better job, but it is one of those things where life does get very busy. But yeah, I love connecting with especially the new grads and the recent graduates in our industry, because they are the future, where we're stepping forward, and creating some camaraderie between us, I think, is so important. Yeah, because it means if you've got some camaraderie or if you've got a connection with someone, you're so much more willing to step outside your comfort zone or have a go at something different or get involved. And I think that is the way that you keep people in our industry, because that is something that we're struggling with as an industry, is to keep people in it and keep people passionate and keep people wanting to do it. And so if you can form those connections, I think that's really great. Yeah.
I think I read there are about 1,100 cattle vets in Australia. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, about that. Yeah. Mm.
And is that enough for you? How's the supply and demand at the moment?
There's certainly a shortage at the moment. Lots of people are discussing that at the moment, and people are definitely looking for more vets who want to go into rural and regional centres, who want to do large animal work. I'm so biased. I love it. I think that it's just the best. But I guess, if some people, that's not natural for them, However, I'm a massive believer in thinking that it doesn't matter if you were brought up in the country or you were brought up in a rural setting. I think that if you are willing to have a go and you're happy to meet people, talk to people, learn from other people, I think that's such a big thing. And just be like, yeah, let's just have a crack and see how it goes. As a young person, I think that speaks volumes, and I think that's how we need to get into it. Yeah.
What would you see as the main opportunities and also the challenges facing young vets?
Yeah, opportunities. There's heaps out there because there's so many jobs. Yeah, and opportunities is that now, because there are so many jobs available and people are looking for so many people, there are a lot of people out there willing to teach. So that's a huge opportunity. I think also a big opportunity is the fact that the markets are so great. People are willing to, they want to do their best. They want to do great things with their animals, and veterinarians are a really, really big part in that. They're making sure that people are able to produce a quality animal that is healthy and well, and that's a big thing. And consumers drive that a lot as well. So opportunities, that challenges. It's a different world. It's a busy world. Everybody wants everything yesterday. And so I think sometimes keeping up with that, the pace and the speed of things, can be really challenging, especially if you're a new grad, because you're just trying to navigate getting to work some days, let alone actually do, that you've got so much going on in your mind as a new grad. You are learning something every day, and it doesn't have to necessarily be veterinary related. It could literally just be how to use a machine as a new grad, So those challenges is that it's a faster paced world. It's very busy. It can be very demanding, and I think that becomes quite a big challenge for people.
Yeah,
for young vets. Yeah,
and I think with such a shortage at the moment, that is inevitably resulting in a lot of stress on vets, particularly. I don't know if it's COVID related or what. Mm. So, how do you manage that, or what advice would you give to sort of particularly younger vets starting out?
Never ever. Feel embarrassed about how you feel. I think that's the biggest thing. I've definitely experienced a little bit of that in my career, a little bit of burnout, and I certainly get uptight and a little bit stressed about things. And I think it's just never feel embarrassed. Be humble enough to talk to somebody about it. And I know everybody says it, but it is so true, because when you can talk to someone, it all of a sudden will feel so much more manageable, and it will also feel just a little bit more weight is off your shoulders for a second, and it gives you a little bit of breathing space to reason with the things that you are stressed or you're worried about. And so, I think, yeah, talking about it is a big thing, yeah.
And I think that ties in with the work you're doing with the ACV, the cattle vets, the camaraderie you're building with the younger vets, and having that network to people to know who to talk to must go a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also if the more faces that you see and become familiar with, the more likely you are to be able to connect with them. And I'm the type of person that if I was to see someone struggling, it wouldn't matter really if I knew them or not. If they came up to me and they wanted to listen to me and that was the thing that helped them out, I would be so open to that, you know, because it is important to let it out, because if you bottle it up, you'll just end up not in a great place.
I'm going to finish with a left field question, if I may, about pain relief, because I'm quite intrigued by it. My understanding is that pain relief is mandatory for mulesing in Victoria, and I read yesterday, I think it was in the Weekly Times, that New South Wales might be next. What might this mean for the beef industry, and are we prepared for whatever changes might be coming?
Yeah, look, I can only speak from personal experience, but from the area that I've been working in geographically, the uptake of pain relief in the beef industry has been fantastic. We've been really, I'm quite passionate about it, and some of the vets that I work have worked alongside are incredibly passionate about it as well. We see the fact that it will help, or I guess we see the fact that it's the way of the future. It's going to be involved. You need to take it on board, I believe. I personally, I'm a big advocate for it, you know, and most producers are as well. We have found that in our area that most producers are more than happy to do it because, you know, they can see the difference. My dad, for example, he could be sometimes a little bit hard to on some new things, I suppose, in contrast to what I said earlier. But he, you know, I said to him, let's try this and let's see what happens. And me, you know, at the end of that day when the calves were walking out with their mums after branding and they were happy to keep up with everybody and no one was trailing behind, that was the big difference for him. And I feel as though you'll find a lot of producers are like that. Most producers want the best for their animals and they want everything to be as calm and as pain-free as possible. And I think it's definitely a big thing that's going to come in the future, for sure.
Em, you've been a great sport. I could just keep talking to you all day. It's fascinating, but I know you've got bulls to get home and the rest of the sale to catch. So thank you very much for your time.
No worries, Beck.
And all the best with your new chapter.
Thank you, Beck. Thank you very much.